Coming to you live from King's Landing, it's the Hand Plus podcast brought to you by Movie Change Up, where each week, normally we break down this week in streaming, what's been going on in streaming from HBO Max, Amazon Prime, Netflix, Disney Plus, all your other favorite streaming services. But this week we wanted to do something different. We're a little behind schedule. We understand that. We know that. We've just had a lot going on in our lives, but we want to do something a little different this week, like I said, and we're just doing a straight-up House of the Dragon Season 1 wrap-up special, where we're just going to be talking strictly about House of the Dragon this week, kind of give our thoughts on the entire season. It's probably, in my opinion, the biggest and best show on television the last 10-ish weeks, last 2.5 months, and so we thought it deserved its own special. As always, I am your host, Gio Fricke, with my co-host Tristan Mayer. Tristan, how much did you hate this show? I understand you were severely let down and disappointed, and it kind of left you wondering why they even made it, but I just wanted your quick thoughts.
Look, you know, I wouldn't go that far, Joe. I had a good time with this show. I'm going to be more negative than you, I think, because I know you're very, very positive on this season. You said it was better than Game of Thrones was, and I'm not quite to that height, so maybe I'll be a bit of a pessimist this review here, but yeah, I mean, I loved this so far. I think there's a bunch of bumps along the road that I'll get to as we go further into the episode, but I think as a first season, especially as a revival for this IP in this world, I think this is such an effective entryway back into the world. I would love to talk to somebody who wasn't a Game of Thrones fan to see what they thought of this as like its own show, but as a continuation of something that I already fell in love with, and this is more what I loved, and it seems like it's going back in the right direction after a bit of a downfall from the end of the last show. But yeah, a great start, and I can't wait to talk more in detail about the characters and the plot. So yeah, if you haven't seen it, we're going to be getting into deep spoilers as we go along, so go ahead and watch the season and come back and then check out the video here.
Yeah, this is definitely not just like a hey, should you watch this, should you not. If you've been watching our show, you know that we definitely be recommending this show to you. This is more of for the people who have been watching it and just curious what our thoughts and opinions are on it. Honestly, just kind of a quick wrap up. It definitely covered a large timeline. It covered, I would say, 20 to, probably someone out there has the exact amount of years, but I would say roughly 20 to 30 years, kind of leading up to the infamous Dance with Dragons. That if you're a Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire fan, you know exactly what the Dance with Dragons is. And season one felt pretty much just kind of a build up to that. It was more of a prologue. So when the Dance with Dragons starts, you know what's going on. You understand the characters. And I think we're kind of done with the time jumps as far, I mean, obviously if they turn this into an anthology type show where two or three seasons cover one part of the timeline, another two or three seasons cover a different part of the timeline. But as far as next season and maybe the season after, I don't really see us having any kind of major time jumps. But season one kind of reminded me of the 70s and 80s miniseries roots of just covering one family and having time jumps in between episodes and replacing actors for characters, for some characters and not others. And that was kind of one of the thing that threw me off for a bit, is trying to figure out who was who and kind of losing attachment to a character a little bit just because they've been replaced by a different actor. And I saw a lot of people praising some of the actor choices, and I thought all of the actors did a good job, but sometimes there were scenes where parents were interacting with children and it looked like the children was older than their parent, and that threw me off quite a bit. I'll say that.
Yeah, the recasting and the time jumps, that is what I talked about, bumps along the road. Those are kind of the bumps that I was talking about, because I think the beginning of this season is really, really strong. I love the young cast here of Emilia Alcock as the young Rhaenyra, who is later replaced by Emma Darcy. And then you also have, oh God, who is the young? Olivia Cooke plays the older version of Alicent, and then you have Emily Carey as the younger version of Alicent. And I thought both of the younger actresses were great, and my biggest bump is honestly that I wanted more of them. I would have loved to see a whole season of that cast before we jumped ahead a bit. And especially when you look at how much plot they had to cover, it does make sense that they're moving along quickly. But, you know, part of the fun of the Game of Thrones was that it was really taking the time and really like monotonous almost. It's like, okay, we're going to have an entire episode that's just about them on the King's Road going from Winterfell to King's Landing, because we're going to have to really deal with the details of this world and the time it takes to go places and do things. And I think some of that minutia is lost here when we're jumping around so much. We're just going to the major plot points and then to the next major plot point, to the next major plot point. You're missing some of that kind of humanity underneath of seeing the characters just kind of doing their daily lives, going about their business, that kind of a thing that I think really helped Game of Thrones in the beginning. But yeah, I'm hoping that season two has less of the time jumps, because that was my biggest issue here, especially in the recasting. I really started to attach to the main leads, and then to have them just replaced, it felt a bit of a like a disjointed show. It almost felt like I was watching a different show all of a sudden halfway through, and it took a bit of a time to get used to that for me.
Yeah, and it really threw me off how, like, in my opinion, I feel like everyone, like, I think Olivia Cooke did a great job as, you know, the older Alicent Hightower, and I think Emily Carey did a great job as the younger version of Alicent Hightower. I just felt like you go from Millie Alcock to Emma D'Arcy, who look like there's 20, you know, years in between their ages, and then Olivia Cooke and Emily Carey, who look like, if you had a movie where Olivia Cooke played Emily Carey's younger sister, I wouldn't question it. And I think for me, that I think to me that was probably the biggest problem, is I think Olivia Cooke did a great job for what she had, but I feel like to me she was the biggest miscast, because she didn't really look the age she was supposed to be playing, and I don't think they did her any favors trying to make her look older. I feel like they could have added some gray strands in her hair and have done something to make her appear older. But when she's 28 talking to her, you know, 20-year-old son, it's just kind of, it would always just take me out of it.
Mm-hmm. I do want to say they're doing a great job with that character this season. Alicent in particular, I think, is having a lot of complex development. And if you're not familiar with the source material for this, it's based off of Fire and Blood, which is not necessarily a novel. It's more of a fake history book, mm-hmm. written by historians from the world of Ice and Fire. So it's all kind of canon within the world of Song of Ice and Fire, but you're not given a lot of detail. It's just kind of the base history notes of what happened. And I think Alicent and Rhaenyra are particularly light in their characterization, especially Alicent. She's just kind of like, you know, the bad guy queen in the book. And this is doing a lot to add to her character and to add to that relationship in particular. I think they did some great work at the beginning with their friendship and their relationship and kind of building up the fact that they had this closeness and this tight bond before, you know, we get to the dance, before we get to their ultimate betrayals and backstabbings. I think that work with the young actresses, with the young characters, really, really helped as we got further along. Like you said, we're finally to the part of the dance, but it took an entire season to get there, and I think that was a good thing. I think that first season of build-up definitely got us, particularly with the characters, a lot of understanding of their motivations, and even when we don't understand their motivations, they're playing it vaguely on purpose, you know? I look at someone like Damon, and I feel like I still don't quite get what his entire motivation is in certain scenes, and he's kind of like an enigma of a character, and that can be frustrating, but I think that's also really entertaining and adds to that idea of, like, it's only history, it's what we remember, it's not necessarily what happened, and we're never going to quite fully understand some of these characters. And I think that's part of the theme of the show, is that history is what the Meisters write of it, and we might not fully understand why somebody does something, but that action that we don't understand is going to shape history forever, right? I think that's very fascinating stuff.
Yeah, for me, like, the thing I got from Damon the most, I feel like especially in the first few episodes when it was kind of the only really main Targaryens there were Damon Targaryen, King Viserys, and King Viserys's daughter, Rhaenyra, were really the only ones where he felt like he could kind of step in and become second in line, because people may not see Rhaenyra as queen. They may not want a female queen. But when he started having sons, and Daemon went from could be second in line to 10th in line, I think he kind of had the realization of, like, my time has passed. If I was going to make a move, if I was going to become king, it would have happened. I should have done, if I was going to do something to make that move, I would have done it earlier. And I think over time it was more, his mentality went more from I need to be king, or I want to be king, to I just need to protect House Targaryen. Mm-hmm. And I think the moment, we talked about it the episode after the show aired, but the moment that was completely ad-libbed of the crown falling off his brother's head as he was dying and moving up to the Iron Throne, and him placing the crown back on his brother's head was kind of the culmination of that, of him basically relinquishing that attempt at power and acknowledging maybe even to himself that I'm done chasing this crown.
Yeah, that to me was like a highlight moment, not just of this season, but of the whole entire Game of Thrones franchise. That moment when Viserys is climbing up that throne. You know it's for the last time, and yeah, really, really powerful stuff. And in that moment, you can tell he felt like he saved his family. You know, he felt like he subverted the dance, and he made peace happen for just a second, you know? And it's like a little tiny tease of, like, what these people can be capable of if they just got along a little bit, you know? Yeah. If they weren't just... So, if it wasn't for the fact that power corrupts people and power draws people naturally to it, you know? And there's those little moments, even in Game of Thrones, of, like, where it's teased of what peace could be in the realm. And that's one of those moments where they could have had this, and they were so close to having it, but the greed of these characters is just too much.
Yeah, legitimately, because... Well, to go back to that moment really quick, I think if we were to do a Mount Rushmore of game, a Song of Ice and Fire moments, the moments in Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, I think the Red Wedding, obviously, it's a Mount Rushmore moment. I would put the Littlefinger's Chaos Isn't a Pit, Chaos Is a Ladder speech in there, and then I think I'd probably put Daemon putting the crown on his brother's head as a third moment. I don't know what that fourth moment or maybe another moment I might kick off for another one, but I definitely think that's a Mount Rushmore moment in Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon.
Yeah, and that's awesome. I love that they were, first season, they were able to get a Mount Rushmore moment, and it wasn't a moment that was just, like, the Red Wedding, of course, is going to be cool because it's a huge moment in the books, and all you got to do is not mess up the adaptation of it, you know? And this is a moment that was not really in the books at all, and they were able to make magic out of it, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't even in the script. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Overall, they've done a great job with the adaptation here. I know you haven't read it, but I've been really impressed so far with how they've taken the beats of the history and added a lot to it and changed stuff to it. Like, for example, in the finale, they have the action sequence where the dragon kind of attacks another dragon, and that kind of kicks off the whole entire dance as this dragon chomps down another dragon, right? And in the book, they don't imply at all that the dragons have any level of autonomy, or like that the dragon made that choice himself, but the dragon got mad and the dragon bit it. And the show implies that the dragons are very autonomous, have their own personalities, their own emotions, and that's really fascinating. I think that's going to be an interesting twist into the lore. How do you control these beasts that have their own minds and their own thoughts and their own desires as you get into this big war? And they've added a lot to the characters. Like, for example, Rhaenyra in the book is... Even as the main quote-unquote character of the storyline, she's still not super developed, and we're getting a good amount of her with Daemon and kind of understanding like what she sees in Daemon a bit more than we got in the book. I think they're doing a great job adding stuff while maintaining the beats. You know, they haven't changed the story drastically, but they added in the prophecy stuff, I think, is working better than I thought that it would. All that stuff seems to be paying off more than I thought that it would, the changes here.
Yeah, because... You know, going to the prophecy, I think if Valeris doesn't say anything as he's dying, doesn't, because he thinks obviously he's talking to Rhaenyra, or who knows who he thinks he's talking to, his mind is slipping away into death. But if he doesn't say anything about King Aegon and he'll be king and all of that, I think Alicent Hightower relents, allows Rhaenyra to be queen, and just says, hey, I tried. But that's not what the king wanted. That's not what the king, you know, that's not what the realm wants.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was, after that dinner, fully accepted to herself that she's just going to, you know, let it, you know, accept the fact that her kids will be lords, but they won't be kings. And, injecting the prophecy into it and doing that whole thing, you fully understand why Alicent Hightower has that change of heart, and you kind of understand why someone will root for her. I see you're team green. I'm team black all the way. You know, they got the better characters.
Yeah, you know, I do tend to root for the villains in Game of Thrones. But yeah, I'm impressed by how much they've given to Alicent. And yeah, I think the prophecy is adding a lot to the humanity of that side. You know, if you think that there's a little prophecy about the savior of the universe, like, you're going to do what you can do to get yourself on the throne, right? If you think that you're the savior of humanity, right? So you're going to do what you have to do. And I think this prophecy's added a lot to that theme I mentioned earlier of history being subjective, and the history is what the reader or the writer makes of it. And I think, in a way, prophecy is what the reader or the writer makes of it. And we've seen back in Game of Thrones, 200 years after this, people are still reading the same prophecy and still coming up with their own ideas of how it applies to them in their lives, or whoever they want to be on a throne happens to fit this prophecy. Like, how convenient. And I think that they're doing a great job with that here, where both sides have read this prophecy and are convinced that they're the savior of the universe, you know? And when you think you're the savior of the universe, you're going to fight pretty hard for it. And I do empathize with Alicent. You know, she put in the work. Rhaenyra, she was born, and she kind of just said, well, I was born, so I should be queen. And for me, I appreciate Alicent because she put in the hard work. You know, she went in there and she did her queenly duties for old decaying Viserys. How many times, you know, she played by the rules. She did what she was supposed to do, but now she doesn't get to get, you know, her pay afterwards. You know, so that's my empathizing with Alicent. I think that, sure, technically by the hierarchy of, you know, monarchies, maybe it should be Rhaenyra, but monarchies are not great, you know? Maybe we shouldn't go by monarchy rules.
But also, I can't let Otto Hightower win. I hate that guy. So I love Rhys Ifans. I've loved him ever since I saw him in The Replacements. He's great in The Amazing Spider-Man. I just can't let him win.
No, I really... Otto Hightower, great character. You can see, like, just from the first episode, I was really into him as just this small supporting role, but great cast, you know, and I love that they got him in there. And yeah, I'm really curious to see what they do with his character, with the Hightowers in general, because there's a lot of interesting lore and theories about the Hightowers and the Meisters and some kind of conspiracies behind the scenes that I'm picking up that the show might actually be running with. So I'm curious to see where they go with some of that stuff.
I don't know if you want to tell them on the air or off the air, but I definitely love to hear those theories.
Yeah, I can go into some detail. I'm not going to spoil anything because it's such a light theory that there's not much to spoil. But essentially, there's this theory among the Song of Ice and Fire fandom that the House Hightower, and which is also the capital of the Citadel, which is where the Meisters are located, which are like the doctors and the studies and the sages of the world, are located there. And there's a theory that the Meisters have sort of this grand conspiracy to get Targaryens off of the Iron Throne, and that they've been working for that even into the future, into the Game of Thrones time, to make sure that magic is not part of the realm, to make sure that everyone believes in the science and history that the Meisters teach, and not in magic, and not in prophecy, and not in anything that could be mystical or not explained by their scientific rules. And I'm wondering if they're leaning into this Hightower stuff, they're leaning into Otto Hightower in particular, and I wouldn't be surprised if in future seasons we spend some time at the Citadel and explore that a bit. You know, Sam was there in Game of Thrones for a little bit. That's where he found out about Jon Snow's parentage, I believe, and a good amount of other lore dumps. And there's also the fact that in the books, they have not yet finished the books, of course. I'm sure you know that, but at the point they are in the books, a lot of characters are all at the Citadel, and it seems like there's a lot of coincidences of characters lining up in the Citadel, and it seems like maybe George has some story to tell involving the Meisters in the Citadel, and he might be using House of the Dragon as his means of telling it, because maybe the books are not quite coming along.
Yeah, I have theories on the books.
Basically, be interested in that. I think, yeah, I love the idea of, like, this secret conspiracy, and I like the idea that everyone has their game. Even the Meisters have their game of getting who they want on the Iron Throne, and everybody's trying to play their little games and move the wheel in their direction. I think that's just really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, my theory on the books are George R. R. Martin's had the books finished for about 3 or 4 years now, but is too afraid that people aren't going to like the ending, so he's just waiting for him to die to have them released so he doesn't have to hear people's dislike of them.
We'll see, and I wouldn't be surprised. We've got a year and a half probably until the next season is out. I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe we get one. Maybe we get Dream of Spring. Or not Dream of Spring. We're going to get Winds of Winter. Maybe. Maybe we'll get Winds of Winter before season two. You know, I said that how many times during Game of Thrones, but yeah. I believe it. You know, I believe it this time. We could get it.
Yeah, so many people, I remember, like, reading thoughts that when Game of Thrones started, people were like, oh, I hope, like, what's HBO going to do when George releases the books before the show finishes and all the show spoilers are out? And during the entire run of Game of Thrones, not a single book in that run was released. He released other kind of side books, but...
Yeah, that's pretty rough. Yeah, the last Game of Thrones book came out, I believe, between season 1 and 2 of the show. So we've been waiting since then for the book.
Yeah. Oh, well. So you got... All right, go ahead.
You go for it, Joe. What do you got?
I just more had a question for you of, like, is there characters or thoughts, like, going going into season two that you want to follow? Is it, you know, are you, you know, your team green? Are you all about following maybe the new king? Are you following maybe his brother, one-eyed brother Aemon? Maybe Daemon? Like, what characters are you looking forward to seeing in season two?
Yeah, I really like Aemon. I can't wait to see what happens with him, and I can't wait to just see the aftermath of this finale, right? Because we saw a lot of the action in this finale, and now it's like the Reds are going to be out for the Blacks, and the Reds are going to be out for blood, you know? And they're going to be ready to get their vengeance, and I think it's going to be a big strike back next episode, next season. So I, knowing the books, I would expect a good amount of action stepping up. You know, we had some action here and there this season, but of course, as the Civil War gets more and more hot, we're going to be getting more and more action. And I look forward to big dragon fights. I was super impressed by the dragon in the finale. I thought that even back in Game of Thrones and in this show too, they've had a hard time making people riding dragons not look kind of stupid and dumb.
Yeah.
I've always felt like the close-ups of people on the backs of the dragons going like this, like, it's always looked pretty bad.
Yeah.
And, but I thought this finale was the first time it's looked great. So I actually left this finale feeling excited for the dragons. Maybe that's a dorky thing to say, you know, a basic answer. But I was nervous going into this season that the dragons would not look good, and that it would be kind of take people out and almost kill the show if the dragons and the riding of the dragons looks bad. But you bring out the money, you can make it look good, you know?
Yeah. Well, they don't have to waste money on direwolves this year, because wasn't that the whole thing kind of towards this run of Game of Thrones? Oh, if there's a direwolf in the episode, you know there's not going to be a dragon. If there's a dragon early in the episode, you know there's not going to be any direwolves. So.
Yeah, that was their excuse.
Yeah.
But I kind of felt like they didn't know how to write for direwolves. So yeah. They just stopped writing them.
Yeah, that makes sense too. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was the Valyrians. I kind of like, because I didn't read the books, but I see like a lot of people talk online of in the books they weren't, you know, listed or described anything as black. So kind of like the, especially for a visual medium, making them black. So it's very clear that they are not the descendants, that Rhaenyra's children are bastards and not the descendants of House Valyria.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, even just from a storytelling perspective, I think it made sense to change it up a little bit, because with the silver hair, I could easily see everybody blending in really easily, you know? Mm-hmm. If you start casting all white people in every role, mm-hmm. I think that's an easy way for the characters. They're already confusing. It's already characters with the same names from other characters. There's a character named Joffrey in here, and a character named Aegon, and there's multiple Aegons, you know? And a lot to follow, so I think it's good to change it up. But yeah, I think that they're doing a great job with that house too. You know, that was like a very lightly explored house in the book, and they're adding a good amount of depth to them. I really think the time we're spending with the main leader of that house, I can't remember the character's name
the
now.
The Sea Snake, but I don't remember his name.
Corlys, I think his name is.
Yeah, Corlys, yeah.
Yeah, he's doing a great job. I really like his relationship with Daemon. I can't wait to see how that plays out as we go along, because they had that uneasy alliance towards the beginning of the show. And yeah, you can see that they're kind of, you know, on Team Green, because if they went the other direction, that would have been a pretty big, you know, turn of the cloak, you know? So I'm really curious to see how a lot of these houses align themselves as the war starts to get along, you know, because they pick their sides now, but who knows where people will end up once the swords come out and it really gets to the fighting, you know?
Yeah, and especially as maybe higher lords die and their children or grandchildren or, you know, nephews take over, they may have different thoughts and different opinions on who's on what side. And maybe, you know, your grandpa was team black, but team green's winning and you really don't want to die. So you're like, yeah, hell yeah, I'm going to be team green now. Definitely be interesting. I think, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot more of the, like, quote unquote history than I do. But I think next season is probably going to be a lot more kind of like the season finale of different characters going to different houses we know. Maybe the Baratheons, the Starks, the Tarleys, the Tullys trying to get help and support. And I think was it the Baratheon house that they were at the end? Or whose house was it at the end when they showed up and old Daemon was already there?
I thought it was the Baratheons.
Oh, yeah, it was the Baratheons, because people made the joke kind of how the Lord was very similar to Robert, and how he couldn't, I mean, maybe Robert could read, but this guy couldn't even read, and he had to have his hand or assistant or whoever come read the message to him. And
yeah, right. I'm curious to see that because, yeah, like you said, we've been very focused on House on the Targaryens and King's Landing this season. So, yeah, if that's what they're going to do next season, I can't confirm nor deny what the season two plot might be. But it would be nice to see some more houses, some of the more familiar houses, get a little glimpse at Winterfell. What's that like right now? I'm especially curious about Winterfell because if they know about the coming of the White Walkers from the north, like, I would be curious to see Daemon and Rhaenyra go to the wall and like have a conversation about it, you know, because I want to understand where did this prophecy go to? That's one of my biggest questions as we go into the rest of the series is they know about this prophecy, right? They know that there's a coming savior, there's a high type of thing. And we also know that that prophecy gets lost by the time Danny comes around, you know, and
yeah,
Rhaegar digs it up out of some library and finds the prophecy buried. And I wonder, how does that prophecy get lost? How does Rhaegar find it? Why is Rhaenyra not taking action in any way to supply the wall? And I think all of that stuff is going to get answered. I think those are questions they want us to be asking because those are so directly tied to the additional lore they've created here, you know?
Yeah, of what I've known of the family tree of Targaryen, my thought and the most simple answer is it just gets lost with the Mad King of people just assume that it's just another part of his weird, crazy person ramblings.
That's definitely a good theory. I'm feeling that one. Do you have any theories going into season 2? I know you talked about going out and envoying some of the houses, but do you have any theories on characters you might see or anything like that? Any other houses you might want to see?
Touched on the big ones, the ones I care about. It'd be kind of cool to see maybe, you know, with the prophecy, maybe Daemon or someone going up to Castle Black, like, you'd think if they could figure out, you know, maybe trying to, if they don't know about the White Walker, if the Targaryens necessarily don't know about the White Walkers going up to Castle Black and the Starks and trying to figure out maybe what this danger from the north could be. Because you'd think if they knew it was the White Walkers, they'd just fly all their dragons up to the north and just wipe the White Walkers out now while their numbers are smaller, or I would assume smaller, and call it a day, but...
Yeah, I'm curious to see what we do. It's going to be a great series going forward, I think. It's going to be interesting in season 2 because they're doing a slight change up in the showrunner, so I'm going to be curious to see how the feel of the show shifts. I think maybe a change of blood would be good for the show because I think the first season was jumpy and jumbled in a little bit. I think maybe a different eye would be good for the season 2. Give us a bit more of a focused and streamlined narrative. That's what I'm hoping for. Because that was what held me back the most. Comparing this to Game of Thrones, I felt like Game of Thrones, the first season, did a really, really good job of telling a singular story and its beginning, middle, and end of Ned Stark's journey and introducing a bunch of characters that I cared about, right? I cared about Arya. I cared about all of her siblings. I cared about Jon. I cared about Jaime. I cared about Tyrion. And so far, this show has... I care about a couple of the characters, but I've yet to be very invested in a lot of the supporting cast, like the wider array outside of the couple of main characters we've been following every episode. I've yet to find like a B character. There's no like Bronn type or something where I'm like, oh, I love that guy who has like a scene every episode.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm trying to think of any other questions, statements I have. Like, one thing I do like about Aemon Targaryen, I definitely feel like if posters existed at in his universe, that he would have grew up with a poster of Daemon, his uncle. Yeah, his uncle, Daemon Targaryen, on his wall. Because I feel like that man has got to be his hero. Just his personality, the way he dresses, everything about him, I got to imagine, is all because of him looking up to his uncle. Because they're the same. Their names are literally the same, just with the D at the end instead of the beginning.
Yeah, he's like picking up his mannerisms and that kind of stuff. So yeah, you can tell the influence. He's like a little bit of a fanboy, you know, of his uncle. I think that's pretty cool. Yeah, before we end, I think it'll be interesting to talk about how the show was received overall, because I have the viewership numbers up here, which I think is really impressive, because they've been doing we talked about the premiere, and how the premiere, I think it was 9.99 million viewers. You know, I can round it up to 10 million for the conversation. 10 million viewers, that's pretty great. That includes the initial views on HBO Max, or the initial views on HBO, and then also HBO Max. So that's a pretty great premiere for HBO. That's the largest single-day viewership of anything in the entire service of HBO. So that's pretty great for them. And every episode since has really done great. You know, they didn't have a big drop-off. Of course, it dropped off a little bit because not everybody who watches the premiere is going to come back and watch the rest of it. But by the finale, they maintained 9.3 million, so they didn't lose a ton of people. No, and that's great.
That's pretty good. One, if you don't have much else to say, one last thing I wanted to ask you is, so kind of what kicked off all of the stuff in Game of Thrones was Ned Baratheon, or not Ned Baratheon, Ned Stark finding the note about the Baratheon children saying the seed is strong. Do you think from his, basically the guy who raised him, Jon Arryn, do you think, in former Hand of the King, do you think there's any chance there was kind of a double meaning in that? Because it's not a theory of myself, this is one I saw online, that he, to kind of point whoever would find it in the right direction, leading back to the old, the Valyrian children are bastards of the Strong household, to kind of, where the word strong maybe in his message would have double meaning.
That's a good pun. I like that for sure. And I think it's definitely, they're trying to remind us of that specific plot point, right? Because yeah. It's the same exact thing. It's the hair is not the same, so therefore, you know, they can't be related. It's the pundit scores of Westeros. You know, hair defines everything in Westerosi yeah. DNA. But that would be a great twist if they actually were intending that. I would love that.
Yeah, I saw that, and I'm like, if they actually figure that out and like rework that theory backwards to include that, I'm like, that's cool.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun going forward to see how much they work backwards stuff, you know, because whether they admit to it or not, they have some repairing to do on Game of Thrones. So I'm curious to see how much they take under their weight here. Like, are they really going to try and go back and use this prophecy and use all of this retconning to make the ending of Game of Thrones make sense and be good? Because that would be very, very impressive work. If they're able to pull that off over the course of a couple of seasons here, I could see them doing it. I could see them going through and maybe changing out that prophecy in some way to make it a play more directly into the events of the ending, right? Where it plays more into Dany going bad, it plays a bit more into Jon Snow as the kind of middle-of-the-road Targaryen. I don't know. Like, I could see them doing some work here to save that finale, Joe. And I would be so happy for it.
How would you feel if they did something where the prophecy actually directly connects to the finale of House of the Dragon? Maybe there's a threat. Maybe someone in the Stark family, who's ever leading the Starks, is, you know, the Dance of Dragons is going on, and they're like, this is some crap. You know, all you guys are fighting or splitting the realm. The realm's, you know, opening ourselves up to outside threats. And they try to basically take over and become leader of King's Landing. And then one of the Targaryen basically has to step up, unite House Targaryen against the Starks at the end and kind of shut down a mini rebellion. So you could almost say that's what the prophecy was about. It wasn't about the White Walkers. It was about the Starks coming from the north and uniting the realm and kind of making the Starks, I don't want to say like the villains, but the antagonists. And then you realize, like, I feel like it almost makes it better for Game of Thrones because you realize, okay, the prophecy doesn't really fit that because it was never really meant to. They were going off an old prophecy that's already been fulfilled.
Yeah, I think that would fit really well too with the theme of the show of like people apply history to themselves and the fact that I honestly feel like the prophecy applies to a ton of people, and that's mm-hmm. what people are missing in the world is that they're reading it and thinking it's about one individual savior, but my reading of the prophecy seems to be, especially in the show take of it, that it's talking about a lot of different people and a lot of different events that are all kind of culminating into this one prophecy. So I could see them doing a twist like yours where the prophecy is also talking about the ending of House of the Dragons, also talking about the ending of Game of Thrones, also talking about the Long Night hundreds of years ago. It's also talking about, you know, the return of the White Walkers in 500 years in the future. And I think that's sort of like the Chosen One prophecy in Star Wars, right? Like balancing the Force, that can mean a lot of things, you know? Sure, Anakin balances the Force, but then Palpatine comes back again and Rey's got to balance the Force, you know? So I could see them doing something like that where the Azura Ahai is not a singular person. Azura Ahai is you know,
an idea,
a culmination of multiple people, an idea, a concept, you know.
Yeah, and like with George Lucas, you know, it's been reported that when George Lucas's original treatment for the sequel trilogy, it was going to be revealed that Leia was the ultimate, chosen one. So
that would have been cool.
So yeah, like, and then you even look at Harry Potter. It's like if Voldemort didn't go back and attack Harry's family, then Neville Longbottom would have been the chosen one. And, you know, there's multiple chosen ones. There's never... I feel like the Matrix... I mean, granted, I didn't see Matrix Revolutions, and so maybe this could be part of the chosen one as multiple people, but I feel like that's the only one where it's like, no, the chosen one was always this locked in one person. It's never really been a chance at anyone else.
Well, I will say Matrix 4 does similar things. It says the chosen one's not quite as binary as you might think.
Okay, well then there you go. There's never been one chosen one. It's always multiple people. It's always multiple things. So
yeah, and I can't wait to see who they have the chosen one be here. You know, is it going to be the easy answer and have it be Rhaenyra as our ultimate savior at the end, or are we going to have a bit of a twist? You know, similar to how Game of Thrones, you thought it was going to be Jon Snow, and then it was Arya comes up and saves the day at the end. I'm curious to see if they build up some kind of B-level character they can bring up and be like, oh, actually, they're the ones who are, you know, the chosen one here.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe whoever Henry Cavill's going to play, because he said, screw you, Witcher, I'm done with your crap.
He's already got someone to play, Joe, let me tell you. He's a little bit...
I mean, I understand all the Superman talks going on, but people have done television movies at the same time, but I don't know, other than maybe Pedro Pascal... But it's a lot easier to do a voice on The Mandalorian and a main person on The Last of Us, especially when you didn't even have a full season to film last year, than it is to do two prominent TV shows. And I think there's too much heat around him and somebody else, I can't remember who, joining season two of House of the Dragon. So
I think he would make a great Aegon the Conqueror if they were going to do some Aegon flashbacks.
Yeah,
I think that would be really cool to see Aegon the Conqueror. I would love to do that, but... Yeah, I would love to see him in this. I love Henry Cavill. Yeah. So, yeah, who knows? Next time we talk about House of the Dragon, we could be talking about Henry Cavill in the cast. We could be talking about a new Game of Thrones book. You know, that could happen.
Liam Hemsworth joining House of the Dragon? You never know.
Henry Cavill will play Aegon for like a season, then Liam Hemsworth will come in and swap out. You know, they'll be replacing Henry with Liam again.
Yep. Yeah. Liam Hemsworth is Superman.
Could you imagine?
Liam Hemsworth is Sherlock Holmes.
Now, that would be funny. If you had some kind of DC multiverse movie and you brought out Superman, then it was Liam Hemsworth.
That'd be good.
All right, Joe, any final thoughts on House of the Dragon?
I don't know how long we've been running on here. Yeah, it kind of wraps up my thoughts. I didn't really want to do like an episode-by-episode breakdown, more just general kind of thoughts. I think we have one last piece of business to take care of, and that's our MVP of the season, but I feel like it's going to be pretty cut and dry of who it is.
You think that, so I want to hear your answer. What do you got, Joe?
I think throughout the run of House of the Dragon, we gave MVP to different people, but I feel like there's one thing. If like I had to give an Emmy to one of the actors, there's really one that sticks out. I could see a vote for maybe one more, but for me, my MVP of the season one of House of the Dragon goes to Paddy Considine for playing King Viserys.
Yeah, I definitely think if you're going for an actor, that's a really good option, especially because he's only going to have this season for himself, I imagine, unless he does, there's like flashbacks or something, you know, who knows. But I think that's a good choice. But I'm leading a couple of different directions here. I have two thoughts in my head, Joe, and I want to hear your thoughts on these thoughts, because I think Matt Smith Damon was what really dominated the conversation for this entire season. People were in love with him. People were tweeting about him. The writers were even talking about the fact that everyone is in love with Damon, and I think that comes from Matt Smith's performance. You know, that character lives in Matt Smith's kind of campy, fun energy that he's bringing to it. And I think, yeah, Matt Smith also has a bit of a baggage to him. Doctor Who is a big show. He's a known face from that show. And he had a, you know, he's also in Morbius, known face from Morbius. Shout out to Morbius.
It's Morbin time.
You know, it is Morbin time. But I think Matt Smith is my MVP for the show. Even though, he's going to be in the rest of the season, the rest of the series, so
spoiler,
can
alert.
Give him, well, at least next season, I imagine, you know, who knows about the rest of the show, but he could win later, so that is my only thing holding me towards your King Viserys win, is that this is his season, he really carried this season, but for me, Damon is the personality of the show so far.
Hmm. thinking it over, quilling it over, trying to think, okay, who had the best moment? Because obviously you have, basically their two best moments are tied together with, I think, him putting the crown on Paddy Considine was on King Viserys' head, but also him having that march up. And the more I think about it, we learned that Matt Smith ad-libbed and did something extra. Obviously, there were talks, and like George R. R. Martin said, Paddy Considine added a lot of like layers and different things and to King Viserys that he didn't even know were there, and added a lot to the character. But I can't really think of like one moment, if I can say, where that I saw about at least where Paddy Considine like added something that completely changed things, where I did clearly with Matt Smith. So for that reason, I feel like I would have to switch my vote to Matt Smith. You know, his brother got to sit on the throne. He never did, but he gets the more valuable, the more prestigious, the more noble award, and that is MVP for season 1 of House of the Dragon, Matt Smith.
I like it. Yeah, I think he brought so much to that performance, and he's having so much fun in the role. You know, I'm just loving watching him play this character. It's great, and he's really impressing me. You know, I love Doctor Who, but I wasn't looking at Matt Smith and thinking, oh, he's going to be like a great dramatic actor, you know? And this is proving that I think he has a really, really great career ahead of him. Because he's been struggling to have any real prominent roles since Doctor Who. You know, he has stuff from Star Wars cut, and Morbius was not exactly great. He has Terminator Genesis, you know, not a lot of great work.
I love Last Night in Soho, but other people didn't, and nobody really saw it, so.
Oh, yeah, I liked Last Night in Soho, and he was good in that. But yeah, this is definitely another level of success, especially in terms of widespread acclaim and talk. So I think he's going to have a huge breakout career ahead of this after this now.
Yeah, I'm almost, if the rumors were true that he's was playing a young Palpatine, and if they don't really have any plans for like a young Palpatine, like if they're like, oh, he's going to appear as a young Palpatine or like a young clone version of Palpatine in episode 9, and then we're going to do like a young Palpatine show starring Matt Smith, then I'd be down for it. But I almost wouldn't want him wasted in like a 1 minute scene as like a younger clone Palpatine or whatever the hell they were going to do. I'd rather much more get the announcement, Matt Smith playing a Sith Lord in the High Republic era, Jedi who goes dark in the High Republic, or something. You know what I'm saying? I'd rather have him get to do his own thing rather than 2 minutes of something just to say he was in Star Wars.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if he does. You know, he got along with Disney well enough to be cast in the role, and ultimately it didn't pay off in the movie, but I don't think those ties are severed, you know? I wouldn't. Maybe he will come back, and same way that Mon Mothma actress came back despite having her scenes deleted. I could see Matt Smith coming back and playing on Palpatine in some show or some movie and playing into the fact that he was in the deleted scenes in episode 9, you know?
Matt Smith is Tar Vizsla.
I would love Matt Smith in anything Star Wars, you know? Yeah. Bring him in.
All right. Matt Smith is Random Droid in Droid Stories.
Perfect.
All right, I think that kind of wraps up our show. We gave our MVP of the week. We will be back, I believe, this Tuesday, doing kind of a month of October wrap-up, as well as our top 10 November preview. So check that out on YouTube and all your favorite podcast platforms. And I think with that...
Happy Halloween, everybody.
Yeah, happy Halloween tomorrow. Without further ado, goodbye. Thank you for watching the Movie Change Up podcast. We'd really appreciate if you liked, commented, subscribed, and shared us with anyone you think might be into what we're doing over here. Thank you. Have a nice day.